Hi everyone, it's Drew Perot here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. And on today's episode, we have Marie Forleo, entrepreneur and number one best-selling author on the podcast. She's here to teach us about an important phrase, and that's the title of her book, Everything is Figure Outable. It's a fascinating interview. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, and functional medicine, and especially mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Perot, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is entrepreneur, full-on Jersey girl.
Yes.
And the author of the number one, hear that again, number one New York Times bestseller, Everything is Figure Outable, Marie Forleo. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Drew, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Is this the first podcast you've done since you've had the news that your book hit number one?
Yes.
So I'm proud to be the first person to announce it out there.
Yeah, 100%. And you're also the first thing that I've done where I've actually had a full night's sleep. So
this is
awesome. It's
Which is
really
great.
Good.
It's a health podcast. We want you to sleep.
Oh, 100%. I love sleep more than anyone else, but on book tour, it can sometimes be challenging with delayed flights and the schedule and all that stuff. So I felt really good last night.
What does it mean to you to be at this place now? You've been doing events in different cities.
Yeah.
You just hit, I want to pause before I go to my regular question set and just kind of like check in on the magnitude, because a big part of happiness is also taking a moment to step back and acknowledge the celebratory moments in our life.
Yes.
Right? I think you would have been fine either way if your book hit number one or number two or number three or even didn't make the list.
100%.
But what does this moment mean for you right now?
Yeah. And I want to put a little pin in that for a moment, because I told the team, you know, even if we don't make the list, because that's a very subjective thing,
right.
I said, we'll be fine. I've built a business over 20 years and I've never been on the New York Times bestseller list. So I'm not going to let that stop me from keep going. Would I have been disappointed? Of course, like anyone would, because you're striving for an aspirational goal. But I said, hey, if we don't make it, you know, we might have a frown on our face for like 5 minutes, but then we got more work to do. We're going to keep going. But in terms of what this means to me, first of all, I just started crying immediately, because our entire team has worked so hard to make this book the best it can be. And our intention was, especially around the list itself, for me, it was honestly less about ego and more about understanding how things work in the world, and knowing that if we could get that recognition, that it would give the book a long-term life. At least it would have the chance of giving it a long-term life. And I believe so deeply in this notion, in this philosophy, in this idea, that that's part of where all the tears came from. And then I honestly am still processing a little bit, and I've also just got a lot more work to do, to be quite honest. We're in the middle of the tour. Tomorrow, we're taking a break as a team. I love amusement parks, and I love roller coasters, and I love celebrating and having a good time. So I think there's probably like 12 of us that are going to the movies. We're going to go to Universal Studios. There's haunted Halloween nights that they have here, which is super fun. There's a performance by a dance crew called the Jabberwockies. Like, there's all these fun things that we're going to do. So that's the time for me to really celebrate in the midst of all this and then keep the party train going.
I love it. You know, there's this message that is the core part of your book, which is that everything has a solution.
Yes. Right?
In this phrase, which we'll get to, like, where the origin story of this phrase came from. But in this process of writing this book and being in this moment, can you think of moments along the way where you felt, even momentarily, that I don't know if this is figure outable, of even putting this project together?
Oh, 100%. And the writing of the book for me was an extremely difficult process. Like, I remember Skyping with my best friend, Chris, and going like, goodness, should I just give them back the advance check? Like, I don't know if I can do this. So those momentary feelings of not knowing if you can surmount a challenge, for me especially, I thought, isn't this interesting? You know, I believe so deeply in this idea that everything is figure outable, and I'm struggling to write the book called Everything is Figure Outable. Like, what a meta challenge that is. This book is kicking my ass. And I thought it was great, honestly, because it got me in the same emotional place that I know many of us get to, and that many of my readers might find themselves in when they pick up this book. So as I was writing it, because I was having challenges myself, I think it allowed me to imbue that emotion and that compassion and that empathy for my reader, hopefully, into the page, so that they know we all go through this and it's okay. But once you feel yourself, you know, in a place of self-doubt or not knowing if you can do it, there are tools, there are practices, and there's a belief system that can help you overcome.
I think especially you've been doing this now for 20 years total, like your career. It's easy for anybody who's familiar with your story. And for those who aren't, we're going to get to that origin story and everything and where the book came from. It's easy for somebody to look at you or anybody else and think they already got it figured out.
Yes.
So they don't go through these moments where they don't have it figured out.
Yes.
And yet a big mission and message inside the book is that you're constantly going through that at every level that you get to in your journey.
I use this phrase every single day of my life still. You know, one of the important points I strive to make, I don't pretend I'm Moses coming down from the mountain. I don't believe I have all the answers to life, but I do believe that the figure-outable philosophy and a lot of the tools and strategies we talk about in there can help any person find or create their own answers. And, you know, from little stuff, like right before we went on book launch, my grandmother, she took a turn for the worse and we don't live in the same state. And for a myriad of reasons, I'm the only one who could help manage getting her from where she was into assisted living. So that was really difficult. I remember one day, again, right around this time, the days are packed. I came home and there's a huge flood in the kitchen in New York City. You know, dog had diarrhea, like just the stacking of things. We were like, oh my goodness. And those are little daily stresses. But we all have those moments. We have tiny things that we need to figure out, like a leaky faucet, and we have big things, whether it's a career change or a health challenge or a life-threatening or even a life-altering diagnosis. And we have stories in the book, which we talk about all that, and hopefully we'll get to some of those in our conversation today. But I am absolutely convinced, not just from my own belief, but from the proof that other people have shared with me, that this philosophy is universal and limitless in its application. So you can use it on the tiny stuff, the big stuff, and everything in between.
In your opening chapter, you say, no matter what you're facing, you have what it takes to figure anything out and be the person you're meant to be. I think this is such an important message right now because so many people feel the opposite of that.
Yeah.
They don't feel like they can be the person that they can be. You know, this podcast is called Broken Brain, but it's called Broken Brain because your brain isn't broken and we want to teach you how. And you even say like you say, despite what society, your family, or your mind may have let you believe, you are not broken. Nothing is intrinsically wrong with you. You're not a mistake or a fraud or a fake. You're not weak or incapable. Give us the origin story of how you came to understand and fully embody this belief system.
Well, we got to go back to Jersey for that one. So I want to talk about my mom because she's this super interesting character. She's about 5'3". She has the tenacity of a bulldog. She looks like June Cleaver and she curses like a truck driver. So my mom grew up the daughter of two alcoholic parents in the projects of Newark, New Jersey. And she learned by necessity how to stretch a dollar bill around the block. And when she was little, she made herself a promise that when she got older, someday she would find a way to a better life. And one of my fondest memories growing up as a kid was sitting around our kitchen table on Sundays, looking through the paper and clipping out coupons. She loved teaching me all the different ways that we could save money for our family. She also loved to teach me about the fact that if you saved up what were known as proofs of purchase, that you could get good free stuff from brands like a recipe book or cooking utensils. And one of my mom's most favorite prized possessions was this little transistor radio that she got from Tropicana Orange Juice for free. So the radio was shaped like an orange. It looked like an orange. It had a red and white straw sticking out of the side, which was the antenna. And she loved this thing. My mom is one of those humans who is always busy. She's constantly doing something. So I knew the way to find her somewhere around the yard or somewhere around the house when I was little was listening for the sound of this radio. One day I come home from school and I'm walking towards the house and I hear that tinny little sound of the radio, like music blaring in the distance. And as I got closer, I noticed that the sound was coming up from above. And I look up and I see my mom and her radio perched on top of our two-story house. And it was very precarious and it was terrifying. And I was like, Mom, are you okay? What are you doing on the roof? Is everything all right? And she said, Ray, it's no big deal. The roof had a leak. I called the roofer. He said it was going to be at least $500. I said, screw that. I'm going to fix it myself. Another day I come home from school and I hear the little radio coming from the back of the house. So I walk into where the sound was coming from and it was the bathroom. And I push open the bathroom door and there's like dust particles everywhere and there's pipes sticking out of the wall. It looked like an explosion went off. And I was like, Mom, are you okay? What happened? And she said, oh, it's not a big deal. You know, the tiles had some cracks in it. I didn't want the bathroom to get moldy. So I'm retiling the bathroom. Now, Drew, you got to get, my mom is high school educated and this is the 80s. So this is a pre-internet, pre-YouTube, pre-Google world. I never knew where I'd find my mom or what she'd be doing, but if as long as I listened for the sound of that radio, I knew things were cool. So one fall day, I'm walking home from school and I was coming home a little late, so it was dark out. It was already spooky. And as I approach the house, everything is dark and quiet, which gave me that feeling, that pit in my stomach that something was wrong. And in an Italian-American household, when things are quiet, it's not usually a good sign. So I walk in, still dark, hear nothing. And I'm like tiptoeing around the house and I really started to get frightened about what I might find. All of a sudden, I hear these clicks and clacks and they're coming from the kitchen. And I follow that sound and I see my mom hunched over the kitchen table, which looked like an operating room. There was screwdrivers, there was electrical tape, and in about a dozen pieces was a completely dismantled Tropicana orange radio. And I was like, Mom, are you okay? This is like your favorite thing. And she's like, oh, Ree, no big deal. I'm fine. She said, the antenna was a little broken and the dial was off, so I'm fixing it. And I just stood there watching her work her magic for a few moments. And I finally thought to ask the question I should have always asked, which was this. Hey, Mom, how do you know how to do so many different things that you've never done before, but nobody's showing you how to do it? And she put down her screwdriver and she cocked her head to the side and she said, what are you talking about, Ree? Nothing in life is that complicated. If you just roll up your sleeves, you get in there and do it. Everything is figure outable. And Drew, I just stood there like, whoa, you know, like that phrase, it just washed over me.
How old were you at the time?
I was, I don't know, probably about seven, like something in that range, maybe 8 or 9. I don't even remember. It was just such a moment of feeling like I had just heard this profound truth. And that phrase took root in my soul. And ever since, it's been the single most powerful driving force of my life. So in high school, it helped me get out of a toxic and physically abusive relationship. When I was in college, and I'm the first in my family to go to college, it helped me earn these rare work-study positions so that I could help pay for my room and board. Once I graduated, it's helped me get every job I've ever had, from bartending and waiting tables to being on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to publishing in the halls of Condé Nast to selling glow sticks at mega clubs, teaching hip hop, eventually becoming one of the world's first Nike Elite dance athletes, despite having no formal dance training. And then, of course, it's helped me get out of debt. It's helped me save my most precious relationships in record time. And then in a business sense, it has driven the entire thing from, like, you know, having the audacity to start a business at 23 to growing it into what we have today. It literally, at every single turn of my life, it has helped me achieve my dreams.
So before we break down the phrase, I want to just talk about your mom for a second. You know, she grew up in this traumatic sort of situation.
Yes.
And two alcoholic parents, I think you said.
Yep.
How do you think that she became the person that she became and still maintained onto this idea of, I'm still going to figure everything out, even in spite of just the background? I don't know your mom's entire upbringing and situation, but what do you think led to her being that person?
I think, honestly, it was the pain of what she grew up around inspired her to want to make her life different. And I feel like my mom is one of those people who is incredibly resourceful. And she just feels as though she wants to make things better, you know, better for herself, better for our family when we were growing up. And because she didn't grow up around a lot of money and we didn't have a ton of money, it was always about being really creative and being really industrious with what you do have. So I think that we all have this spirit in us, every single one of us, where, you know, we see things around us and we're like, I think we can make it better. But sometimes people don't believe that they have the power to. They might have a little seed of that deep in their heart, but they might not believe they can do it, or no one's ever modeled it for them. So in terms of my mom, I mean, you know, thankfully she's still with us. She's still alive. She's still spicy. She's super salty. She sends me texts all the time with, like, curse words and, you know, all caps. She's a piece of work, but she's amazing.
Did she remember this phrase, everything is figure outable?
Oh, yeah, she totally does. And in terms of the Tropicana orange, so many people, since the book has come out and I first shared the idea on Oprah's Super Soul Sessions, and people just send me Tropicana orange radios because you can find them on eBay.
Right.
And I have like 30 of them in the box. My mom's like, don't throw away any of them. They're so cute. I'm like, Mom, you're a piece.
So the phrase is such a simple phrase.
Yes.
And the concept.
Yes.
And really, when I look at the book and I was reading the book and going through all your material, and you even say it inside there, the phrase is simple, and it's the unlearning and the relearning and really the training of the brain.
Yes.
In fact, you're a perfect guest for this podcast because this book is sort of like updated manual for your brain.
Yes.
To unlearn the things that aren't working and to embrace the things that are. So the phrase is simple and the execution of it, it's not easy, but it's straightforward.
Correct.
But we have to go through the process.
Absolutely.
So let's get into the framework of how somebody, because just because you know this phrase doesn't mean that you can just immediately jump into it and like you see everything in that figureoutable light. So what are the things that hold us back from fully embracing this idea of everything is figureoutable? What do people believe that is the opposite?
Well, I think one of the things to understand to set this context is just the fact of how powerful our beliefs really are. You know, if you don't believe that you can achieve something or learn something or become better in any domain, you won't. That doesn't mean it's not possible, but our beliefs really are like train tracks that underpin our lives. They direct where we go, how we get there, and everything. You know, a lot of people feel like, well, if I just change my thoughts, but where do your thoughts come from? Underneath that is what you believe to be true about yourself and about the world. And so I think we have to look at beliefs first. And I think your question was, how do we start to change, or what holds us back, right?
Yeah. What are the beliefs that hold people back? If one belief is everything is figureoutable.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what's one belief that holds us back from
everything's not figureoutable, or yeah, that people don't have what it takes? I think the belief that I'm not good enough, or I don't have what it takes to become that or do that or be that or change that, that is a belief that can stop you dead in your tracks. And think about it. If you tell your brain, well, I can't, or that's not possible, your brain's not going to stretch beyond your cognitive comfort zone right now and search for new ideas or innovations or go ask questions. So, you know, coming back to the brain, that's why I love this idea, because if you're just willing to play in the arena that everything is figureoutable, it opens up a whole new world of possibilities. I want to do this, Drew. Can we talk into the skepticism that people might have when they hear this phrase?
Yes, please.
Because people listening right now might be like, okay, cute idea, kind of see it, but no, everything's not figureoutable. So when I first started writing the book, I was out to brunch with some friends, and my one friend brought her 10-year-old son along, and they were asking me like, Marie, what are you working on right now? And I said, I'm working on a new book. What's the name? Everything is figureoutable. And the 10-year-old's like, no, it's not. And I was like, oh, okay, mister, tell me more. What exactly isn't figureoutable? And he said, well, we human beings can't grow working wings out of our back and fly away. And I was like, well, that's really interesting. You know, have you heard of CRISPR? That may be coming somewhere down the line. Two, we human beings can indeed fly. And he was like, well, you're right. Okay, well, I can't bring my dog back from the dead, the one that died 3 years ago. And I was like, well, that's true as of right now, but scientists are working on cryogenics and people have been cloning their dogs. And he was like, oh yeah, you're right. So conversations like that inspired me to create a set of rules around the figureoutable philosophy. It's a mental container, if you will, so that we can use this phrase and this philosophy for its intended purpose, which is to help ourselves create positive change and then positive change in our communities and the world around us. So here's how that goes. The three rules of the figureoutable philosophy.
Right.
Rule number one, all problems or dreams are figureoutable. Rule number two, if a problem isn't figureoutable, it's not a problem, it's a fact of life, like death, gravity, certain laws of nature, taxes. Rule number three, you may not care enough to solve this particular problem or reach this particular dream, and that's okay. Go find something you do care deeply about and circle back to rule number one. So those three rules kind of help us set into play how we can approach this idea and start to overcome some of the beliefs that, oh, everything's not figureoutable. You know what I mean? If your brain kicks up this, that, or the other thing. And I'll say one more piece on this, because a dear friend of mine who respects my work actually texted this to me, and we had a conversation about it. He's like, Marie, I love you. I respect everything you've done. I think the title is amazing, but come on, everything's not figureoutable. What about addiction? What about death? What about grief and loss and a life-changing diagnosis? How are you saying that all of that is figureoutable? And I said, well, great question. Let me answer with a story. After I had shared this idea on Oprah's platform, I started to receive letters from people. This is before I wrote the book. So they had only just heard the phrase itself and they took it on and used it to create change in their lives. And one of the letters I received was from a woman named Jen. She said this, Marie, I loved your Oprah talk. This is actually an idea that my mom has been trying to teach me my whole life. We sat down together, we both watched it, and we think it was fantastic. But then something changed. My mom, who's like my best friend, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and suddenly Nothing seemed figure outable. She said, but I really took a step back and looked more deeply at the situation, and here's what I discovered. I could figure out how to find nursing care for my mom, who lived in a rural area. I could figure out how to find foods that she could actually tolerate. And this was the big one for Jen. I could find out how to get medical equipment so that my beautiful mom could spend her last days, and in fact, her last 5 weeks on earth, exactly where she wanted to be, which was in her own home. Mm. So Jen said, I can now say without a shadow of a doubt that yes, everything is figure outable. And thank you so much for sharing this simple phrase that made such a huge difference to two women on the other side of the world. Jen's from New Zealand.
It's such a powerful story because everything is figure outable doesn't mean that you're going to completely 100% fix a situation, like get that person back.
Correct.
But what is the most ideal and best situation you can bring in that circumstance? Because as you said, rule number two, it's that in that situation, her family member getting diagnosed is like gravity. That person has a diagnosis.
Yes. And all of us are going to die sometime, right? And we just know that to be true. So death is one of those facts of life. And one of the things that we dive deeper into the book is about really helping yourself parse through things that are within your control and things that are not. And, you know, that's a little bit of an interesting area. We wouldn't have scientific and medical breakthroughs if someone didn't look at a situation and go, no, I don't think this is true. I'm going to try and break through and change that reality. So I think that's for each of us to decide, you know, what we want to consider. This is an irrefutable fact versus something that you want to see if you can reshape our world. And I would invite viewers to decide that for themselves. But I think on a very fundamental level, understanding that you cannot change someone else's behavior, that you can only really focus on your own, is a great first step into making that distinction between, again, focusing on what you can control versus what you can't.
Because in another universe, that friend of yours whose story is so touching that you just shared, she's super focused on the fact that she's depressed and sad and upset because this is happening to her family member, which is anybody's right to be able to do that.
Of course.
And she's not focusing enough on what she can actually do in this situation. And
Yes. That's
what happens for a lot of people is we focus on what we can't do instead of embracing, okay, this is the reality. What can I do now?
Exactly. And I think you just hit the nail on the head, Drew. It's like all of us are going to face really hard truths in life. No human being escapes that, right? We are all going to be on our knees. We are all going to experience grief and disappointment and loss and some really challenging things. And when those challenging things occur, we do have to ask ourselves, what now? And I think it's in those moments that when we reach for this idea that, well, everything is figure outable, what can I do to lift myself up or other people up given these circumstances? That's where we kind of rise into our full power. That's where we tap into our innate wisdom. And that's where we start to create positive change.
You talk about two viruses.
Yes.
On the topic of belief, you talk about two viruses that can derail us.
Yes.
From this mentality. Can you share what those two viruses are? And what I love about your book is like you kind of give a, you can think of it this way or you can step into this framework.
Yes. So these are two thought viruses that I've seen I have and most of us have whenever we're in a learning environment. And the reason they're so destructive is because our brains actually shut down when we think this way. So here's they are. The destructive thought number one is I know this already. Whenever you find yourself, you know, listening to a podcast, reading a book, being in any kind of educational environment, the moment you have the thought, I know this already, you disengage. You stop listening. You check out. You're off to something else. Or you just think, ugh, this is old hat. But here's what's interesting. Most of the time when you hear the thought, I know this already, instead of listening to that and disengaging, I want people to stop, catch it, and turn it into a productive question. Instead of, I know this already, ask yourself, what can I learn from this? What can I learn from this? Because there's always two things that you can learn. First, the thing that, let me step back. First is you can learn a new refinement or a new angle on a concept that you're already familiar with. So anything that you think you know already, there's probably another layer of mastery to it if you're actually open and have a beginner's mind and that's how you approach it. But more likely, here's what you'll discover. The thing that you think you know, you're not practicing in your life fully right now. Mm. There's a huge difference between understanding something intellectually and having it be operational or functional in your life to the degree that you're getting a benefit from it, right?
Absolutely.
So asking yourself, what can I learn from this? Am I applying this right now? It's a great way to stay engaged and present and help yourself reach that new level of mastery. So that's destructive thought number one. I know this already, and you change it to what can I learn from this? The second destructive thought is this won't work for me. You immediately shut down your brain from any new possibility if you hear something that is outside of what you already know or maybe different than what you expect. And you're like, oh, that might work for that person, but this won't work for me. There's no possibility for growth there. So if you hear that thought pop up in your mind during this interview or any learning experience, stop and change that to a productive question. How can this work for me? How can this work for me? When you ask questions, your brain is designed to answer them. We all know that, right? So if you're asking smart, productive questions like, how can this work for me? You're pushing outside of your cognitive comfort zone and you're challenging your brain to find new innovations and new connections that you wouldn't otherwise discover. I do this all the time in business. So if I find myself in any type of educational environment and I'm thinking it doesn't apply to my industry or it doesn't apply to who I am, I ask the question, how could this work for me? And I always find new valuable ideas or, oh, I could maybe apply it in this way. And these are things I would have never thought of if I just stopped at the thought, this won't work for me.
Because if you don't ask, your brain's not going to even entertain the possibility.
Correct.
It doesn't mean that you're going to have the answer, but you won't even entertain, which means that you won't even get started.
Correct.
I want to go to your story and just hit a little bit of sort of the key moments that are in there, because even when you go off on an adventure, sometimes you have to refine your journey and figure out what the right steps are for you. So in your book, you talk about being the valedictorian of your school.
Yep.
And then going off and like wanting to go on this adventure of creating the life that you want to live. And you ended up on Wall Street.
Yep.
I believe.
Yep.
And just take us from there and hit some of these notes in your story that also relate to you figuring out your journey and continuing to ask yourself this question.
Oh, 100%. So I remember graduating from college and just trying to figure out what my first good job should be. One of the things that I knew was that I had a lot of energy. So sitting behind a desk for 10, 12 hours a day did not sound appealing. So when there was an opportunity to be on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, I jumped at it. I thought it was awesome. It was incredibly exciting. There are literally no seats. There's like these little fold down things that could happen, but nobody sits all day long. And I loved that. But about 6 months into my job, I started hearing these little voices. Marie, this isn't what you're supposed to do. This isn't who you're supposed to be. You're meant to do something different. And at first it started off as a whisper, but then as the weeks and months went by, it got louder and louder. And I kept trying to ignore that voice inside because quite frankly, it wasn't telling me what I was supposed to do and said, just that this wasn't it. And, you know, my parents had busted their buns to put me through school. It's not like I had a trust fund or any kind of backup plan. So it felt wildly irresponsible to just leave a job with healthcare and benefits. And it's like my first gig out of college, not knowing what else I was supposed to do. So one day on the floor, I got into work and I had what I can only identify as a mini panic attack. So I started feeling dizzy. I had trouble breathing and I told my boss that I was going to run out and go grab some coffee. And instead, I made a beeline to the nearest church. So I went to Seton Hall University, which is a Catholic university. So I was kind of trained in a crisis to look up for answers, right? And I'm sitting on the church steps and I was crying my eyes out because I felt like such a loser. All I wanted to do was quit. And the first sign I got was to call my dad. So I took out my flip phone, if you remember those. This Absolutely. Is the late 90s. And
would you have a Motorola Razr?
Oh, I probably. Oh, gosh. I called my pops and I was bawling my eyes out. And he was like, you know, after he could get a word in edgewise, he's like, Ree, calm down. You're okay. He said, look, you've worked since you were 9 years old. If you're this upset, and you've tried so hard to make this job work, but it's not working, and you hear that voice telling you to quit, here's what you need to understand. You're going to work for like the next 40 or 50 years of your life. You have to find something you love. And if this isn't it, then it's okay to quit. I'm not worried about you. You'll be fine. But don't stop searching until you find something that you genuinely love, because then work's never going to really feel like work. And Drew, in that moment, my dad gave me such a gift because it was like a permission slip. I was so nervous that I was going to be a disappointment or that he would feel disrespected because of how hard they worked to put me through college. But it made me realize that he was right. Even though I had no idea how to find something I would love, like that even to the skeptical part of my brain felt irresponsible, the deeper part of me knew he was right.
So if, can I pause you for
yeah,
one second?
Yeah, of course.
Was that the first time in your life that you can remember? I mean, if you're a valedictorian, you know, you're
ambitious, driven,
everything.
Type A.
Was that the first time that you had quit something? Like that was a pretty decent undertaking?
Absolutely. I mean, I had, you know, I when I was younger, I had tried out for like the cheerleading team and failed many, many years before I got on it. So I was rejected a lot. But this was the first time where I had achieved something that I thought was really good. And then
on the outside looked good to everybody else.
Correct. And then volunteered to quit.
Okay.
Which, yeah.
Yeah. So just wanted to.
Of course.
I have another question about that later on, but I want you to continue with the story. So your dad gave you that permission.
Yes. And then I really was like, okay, well, how do I figure out what to do next? Because I didn't have any clues. So I started bartending and waiting tables again. And my only clues were that as a kid, I was highly creative. So I thought at one point I was either going to be a fine artist or an animator for Disney or a fashion designer. I really liked using my hands and I really liked creativity in that respect. But I also really love small business. My dad was a small business owner and I used to go to work with him sometimes at nights and on weekends and help him do the things that he was doing in the business. And so I loved that world too. So I thought to myself, well, what about magazine publishing? There's the creative side of it. There's the commerce side in terms of ads. Maybe that's where I belong. I went to a temp agency and I hustled my buns off and I got a position as an ad sales assistant for Gourmet Magazine, which was amazing. You know, I love to eat. I love food. My desk was outside the test kitchen. The editors would always bring me samples of whatever recipes they were working on. So that was cool. And it was a brand new environment. It was very different than Wall Street. But a few months into that job, the voices came back and I was like, oh no, not this again. Marie, this isn't what you're supposed to do. This isn't who you're meant to be. And I literally started to feeling like something was wrong with me. I'm like, why can't I keep a job? But then I stepped back and tried to look at it with a little more objectivity. And I saw that I didn't necessarily want to be my boss who was an account executive. Like I didn't aspire for her job. And then I looked even further ahead and saw the publisher of the magazine, this incredibly powerful, intelligent woman. And I didn't aspire to be her either. And I was like, well, if I don't want to climb this corporate ladder, what am I doing wasting their time and mine? So I thought, well, maybe these past two gigs were a little too numbers focused, right? In the ad sales business, it's all about meeting those criteria. Wall Street, obviously very financially focused. I thought maybe I'm leaning too much on the business side. I need even more creativity. So I went to the HR department and got myself a job as a fashion assistant in the editorial department of Mademoiselle magazine. I was like, okay, this has got to be it. I'm going to fashion shows. I'm working with designers and photo shoots and all this stuff, highly creative. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. Of course, fast forward like 3 to 4 months into that job, the voices came back even louder. Now I'm panicked. I was actually considering, like, is there something wrong with my brain? Nothing makes sense here. How could I have been the valedictorian of my class? I have a very strong work ethic. I like working. I want to work. I want to contribute somewhere. But I can't deny that my body is revolting in these jobs. It does not want to be here. And I'm having a hard time staying focused and I just want to quit. So there was one day when I was on the internet, probably when I shouldn't have been, and I stumbled upon a new profession at the time. I'm doing bunny ears right now for those of you listening. It was called coaching. And again, this is the late 90s. So no one had ever heard of coaching before. Very, very few people. And when I read this article, Drew, something in me lit up like a Christmas tree. It was like as though the clouds had parted and there was little cherub angels and they were like, oh, like this is what you're meant to do. But here's the deal. I was 23. So the logical, reasonable part of my mind was like, this is the dumbest idea ever. Who's going to hire a 23-year-old life coach? You're in debt. You can't even hold a job down. You have nothing of value to offer anyone else. What are you thinking? This is just one more thing you're going to fail at. But I couldn't deny that in my body, it felt right. Something felt different. It felt different than everything else before. So that night I signed up for a 3-year coach training program. I went back to work during the day. And then a few months later, I got a call from the HR department of Condé Nast. They had a promotion for me. They wanted me to go to Vogue. It was more money. It was more prestige. And obviously it was a steady job with healthcare benefits and all the normal things that young people want these days. And that was my fork in the road. And it was like either stay on this path and work for the best fashion magazine in the world, or quit and do this weird ass life coaching thing that part of my brain thinks is ridiculous, but the other part of me feels like is so exciting, I can't help but just follow it. So I quit my job and started bartending and waiting tables at night and on the weekends so that I could figure out how to build my coaching business during the day. And that was 20 years ago.
You know, what I love about that story is that there's like so many like notes and messages that are inside of there. The first thing is that you wouldn't have known that those jobs were not the right fit if you didn't go for it.
Correct.
At that time, that was the best answer that you knew.
Yes.
It was the best option. You said, okay, maybe I need to go in this direction.
Yes.
You didn't overthink it and you got started, which is a key theme inside the book.
Yes.
It's like you just went for it and you took the action instead of sitting in your apartment or house or whatever and saying, well, would I like to work in magazine career? Well, I don't know. Maybe it'd be good. And just staying in the old thing that you were in.
Yep.
And the voices, which are scary and everybody's had them before.
Yes.
You didn't ignore them. Even though they are scary, they're telling you something.
Correct.
They're trying to be a compass and pointing you in the direction. And I don't know exactly your framework and your mental framework at the time, but you had the courage to leave when it was time.
Yeah.
And not to have guilt on yourself for being a failure and defining yourself as a failure.
Yeah, I want to be really transparent here. When I first heard the voices, I did try to ignore them because they were so uncomfortable to hear, right? So I tried to push them down, but they kept getting louder and louder. And I think many of us have those experiences in relationship. We certainly have them with career, where you might hear something and it's almost like a little faint whisper and you ignore it. And then it gets louder and louder until something happens where you can't deny it anymore. So I certainly didn't listen the first time I heard the whisper. It took me getting to a real point of pain. And for me personally, when things aren't aligned in my life, it shows up physically. Like I physically start feeling ill. Like my body literally revolts. It's almost like I can't sit still or I get nauseous or do you know, there's like physical manifestation.
Cramp in your stomach.
Absolutely. And just like on the floor that day, I started getting dizzy and had trouble breathing because it was an inconvenient truth. Mm. And if I ignore those, I pay big time. So that was the one thing I wanted to note there. The second thing I wanted to note, I believe that every single person, everyone listening right now, has such incredible innate intelligence inside of them that is not born from their rational, logical minds, that we have intuition that is guiding us to what our best life possibly could be. And that doesn't mean it's always going to be comfortable. It's not always going to be rainbows and daisies and unicorns. But if we're just not taught to go inside for the answers and to go inside for that direction. Most of us are taught to ask other people or to pay attention to society's expectations. That was actually another gift that my mom gave me when I was young, was teaching me that there was such a thing as a still small voice and that I always needed to listen to it and that it would always help me. She taught me that in the context of just staying safe. I was a very independent minded kid and I always wanted to walk myself to school and walk home and I just wanted to do things on my own. And she's like, look, I'll let you do that when I was old enough, as long as you promise me that you will listen to the small voice inside if a car pulls up and tries to get you to come over. Or if you hear someone approaching you and you feel that little voice kind of saying, hey, it's time to run. You need to listen to that because it's designed to keep you safe. So that was yet another gift that my mom gave me.
Listening to that voice is so key. One of my favorite books is a short little book, like 200 pages. You can read in a couple hours. It's by Seth Godin. It's called The Dip.
Yes.
And it's all about quitting.
Yes.
And I think that when I was reading your book and listening to your story, and obviously I've known you for a while, we're not super close, but I've known of your journey and your story. We have a lot of mutual friends. And I see somebody who was not afraid to go to the next thing, or, well, we'll talk about fear.
Yeah, right? Of course.
I'm not saying that you didn't have any fear at all, but you still took the fear along with you.
Absolutely. Right?
And you were willing to quit. And I think when you hear the voices, there's people who are listening at home today in their car, at home, wherever they are, and they're hearing these voices that are there for them. And they're afraid to quit because they think that quitting something that they wanted, even something that they wanted to do, is going to define them as a failure.
Yeah.
And you have a quote in the book about failure. And you talk about it. I'm going to paraphrase because I didn't write it down. Failure is something about being a character.
Oh, I'll tell you. Yeah. So this is actually something from Judge Victoria Pratt. That this is something I learned from her. She was a guest on Marie TV. She's become nationally known for her work in criminal justice reform. She's like this incredible judge that practiced in Newark, New Jersey. And now she's just off on this other incredible adventure. So this is what Judge Victoria Pratt taught me. Failure is just an event. It's not a characteristic. People can't be failures. Mm. And I was actually posting about this today on Instagram. Here's a great frame on failure. It's a faithful attempt in learning. That's it. It's nothing that we have to be, quote unquote, afraid of. And it's nothing that we should try and avoid. It is a necessary step on our figure outable journey. So you could look at it in a certain framework that I failed on Wall Street. Did I fail though? Or did I experiment, try it, learn something that wasn't for me and I moved on? Same thing with publishing. I'm not a failed publishing executive. I went for it, discovered what it was, contributed as much as I could, and was like, this isn't for me, so we have to move on. So I think for all of us, the frame on failure I like to share with people, it's like if you went to a movie, right? And you sit down in the seat and you've got your popcorn and you're so excited and all these characters on the screen, all the stuff's happening, you're really into the story. And then midway through, they hit a huge conflict. They quote unquote fail. And then you're like, oh, they're a failure. You get up and leave mid-movie. You don't even know how it's going to turn out. And so many people, I think failure is just an incredibly short-sighted concept. You have no idea where your story is going to go unless you truly just give up and are like, okay, I'm just going to sit on the couch for the rest of my life. But, you know, every failure really is a faithful attempt in learning. And if you could just see it as this is just one moment, you don't know where the story is going to go, you relieve a lot of pressure on yourself.
Yeah, so important. And that goes back to when you don't have that belief that you're defining yourself as a failure,
yes,
you ask different questions.
Right.
What's the next opportunity for me?
That's right. And there's some self-distancing too. I think the beauty in Judge Victoria Pratt's notion that failure is just an event, not a characteristic, the self-distancing helps our brain actually see it with more objectivity. So then we say, okay, well, what about that situation didn't go as planned? Or was there a red flag that I chose to ignore? You know what I mean? Or what's the learning here? I love this phrase. Sometimes I'm asked on interviews like, oh, Marie, tell us about some of your biggest failures. And oftentimes I'm caught like a deer in headlights, not because I haven't made mistakes, not because I don't run into walls, because all of us do. But this phrase saved me when I was young. I win or I learn, but I never lose. When I heard that mantra for the first time, I was probably in my late 20s. I was like, oh my goodness, this is the coolest thing ever. I don't know who originally came up with it. It certainly wasn't me, but I adopted it for myself. And I was like, wow, if I crash and burn, I'm not gonna necessarily file it in my brain as a failure. What's the learning here, right? How can I grow from this? And then I move on. So oftentimes when people ask me in interviews, I literally have no mental file folder to go back to that's filled with failures because I don't see them that way. And that's legitimate.
I heard you on the Gary Vaynerchuk podcast.
Yes.
And he was saying that one of the things that he always knew, but he really got it from Tom Bilyeu, that he defined it when he was on his podcast, was that he understood that his superpower, and he saw this in you, and this is why I'm bringing it up, was that he doesn't judge himself.
Yes.
Right? And obviously, he might have his extreme version of what that shows up
of
for
course.
Him. And you've been very transparent. It's not that you didn't go through these things, or you did ignore the voices ultimately, but you're not putting that final judgment that prevents you from moving forward.
Yeah. And let's talk about fear just for a quick moment. I want to talk about something that was really close. So when I was getting ready to launch this book, I had a creative vision that showed up in my mind about how I wanted to launch the book in New York. And it went like this. Imagine if a Beyonce concert and a TED Talk had a baby and then threw a party. That's what I want to do for my book launch. And my publisher, Drew, oh my goodness, there was such silence on the phone when I said that, like that uncomfortable silence, like I just scared the shit out of them. Or they're like, who is this woman? And why does she think that we could actually do this? I was like, look, I'll handle making it happen, but I really want to make this happen. And I often have big dreams, and this one felt really right to do. But the entire process of putting on a concert, I had never put on a concert before. I had never performed in a concert before. Even in my kind of the part of my dance career where I was working with Nike, you know, maybe I taught in front of like a couple of thousand people, but it was different than performing where people weren't doing everything with you and then mixing in a whole talk, this whole thing. We have a video up on our site about the making of what we just did in New York. And I loved it because we showed people how often I was crying. And I still have the thoughts like, what did I get myself into? Can I actually pull this off? Is this thing going to work? So those fearful thoughts, those insecure thoughts, they never go away. But that doesn't mean you can't execute alongside them.
Yeah, I watched a few of those clips and you're very vulnerable then. You know, I saw the clip for what I think was the first time that you were addressing the choreography crew.
Yeah.
And you could see that. You're here. You have this vision. You have this dream. You're a little nervous.
Yes, a lot nervous.
A lot nervous.
There's 100%.
I picked up a little bit of a fear of like, you know, you really setting the disclaimer of, guys, I'm not like formally trained in dance.
Yes.
Like I want to do this, but like you guys know way more than I do.
Completely.
And yet you still did it.
Yes.
And that goes to one of the central themes that you talk about in here is you start before you're ready.
That's right.
Tell us about that. And what does that mean for people who are listening at home?
Yeah. So I've noticed, I've interviewed so many incredible people, and I love to study folks who are just top in their field. And it's a pattern. People who live the lives that they want to live, define success however they want to define it, but are doing them in a big way, start before they're ready. So what that means is just the fact that our minds will kick up this nasty little lie constantly and say, oh, that would be nice to do someday, but I'm not ready yet. You know, it could be about learning a new language, changing your job, making a big change in your health or your fitness, anything really. And our minds always are designed, right, to try and keep us safe and small. But the notion that I'm not ready yet is just, you know, decades can go by and you're still never going to be ready. So a great hack to move around that is just to practice starting before you're ready. So rather than procrastinating and researching for months or years, just dive in head first, like learn through taking action. What does that look like in an active sense? Rather than spending hours online, can you go and take a physical class? Rather than reading about something for months, can you pick up the phone and make a phone call and have an active conversation with someone so you actually start getting into things? It ties into another concept that really helps me a lot in my life, which is clarity comes from engagement, not thought. Mm. So a lot of times we find ourselves kind of feeling this tug of war inside, like, oh, I don't know, should I go explore that new career? And we talk about it for months or years without ever actually doing anything. So start before you're ready. And clarity comes from engagement, not thought, or almost like these great salt and pepper shakers that if you're like, okay, how can I start before I'm ready? Well, maybe I'm going to go sign up for that community college course. You know, I don't feel like I'm ready for it, but what's the worst thing that can happen? And I don't even know if I'm going to like it. Well, clarity comes from engagement, not thought. Let me go take that class and see how it feels, see if I actually enjoy it. And then I'll know whether or not I want to pursue this career change, or maybe this is just a hobby and it just brings joy to my life.
You know, this book is dedicated to your parents.
Yeah.
And you've shared two great stories of your mom and your dad, of them supporting you along the way. I'm sure there's countless others. There are a few questions that I'd asked my audience for to ask you. And one of the ones that came in is that, what do you do when you want to move forward and you want to figure out this next step, but you feel the pressure of whether it's a spouse or parents who are not supportive?
Yep.
You know, when you were changing all these careers and going through different things, I'm sure it wasn't rosy, but it sounds like the background was that your parents were generally supportive of you figuring out what you needed to do.
That's right.
What do people do when they do not have that support
around
them?
First, as I think you have to learn to give it to yourself. Now, understandably, we're all social creatures. So we are undoubtedly influenced by the people around us. But I remember for me, one of the things that was challenging, because my parents have always been pretty much like, you can do whatever you want to do. They know how independent I am. But one of the challenges I found was the fact that none of my friends were entrepreneurs, and it seemed so weird to do this new thing. And I think that it is up to us to create a support system if we don't have it. So one, you have to be your own advocate. You have to just believe in yourself, even if the people around you don't, because you're going to need to lean on that at every single part of your life. And I know this might sound morbid and depressing, but you know, we come into this world by ourselves and we're going to die by ourselves. So we have to learn how to be our own best friend. We have to learn how to be kind and compassionate to our soul and to our heart's desire, and then use that compassion and to start creating some support around us. And that's where I think technology can really be a benefit. Some of the best people in my life, I met them online. You know what I mean? Not through a dating app, but through like just relationships or email or social or some way being connected. Didn't necessarily meet them in person at first, but then developed a connection with them. And a lot of people that are my best support systems right now, I don't live anywhere near them. And so I think anyone listening right now, if you find yourself in that position where there's not a lot of people that support you, take the steps. Maybe that's your first thing to figure out, is how to create a support system. And it doesn't have to be 25 people. If two people you relate to that you can call and support them and they can support you, that's often enough to get you through.
You know, you say you were the first person in your family to go to college. I was the first person in my family to drop out of college.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How, what was that like for you?
You know, Indian family, South Asian. Most of my family members are doctors or very successful people in different avenues. And education is like a big, big, crucial sort of thing. And being in school and recognizing that I'm not learning the things that I want to. You know, I got mostly really great grades when I was in high school, graduated, not valedictorian, but top, you know, pretty top of my class. And my parents were they knew I was a good kid. So they let me go forward with the idea of exploring and taking a year off of school, but they were not happy when I decided to leave school and say that I want to go pursue entrepreneurship. And I'm so thankful for the resistance that they brought in of, they weren't like, you're never going to amount to anything or anything like that. They were just like, look, we want you to finish your degree and this is why it's important to us. And it didn't mean that we have to agree on it. And I went and I created my own network, my own support system that was out there. And I'm thankful for both. I'm thankful for going and finding friends that had the same vision, purpose, life dreams, that we could lift each other up when we all fell down. But I'm also thankful for the fact that my parents were, you know, sharing their truth and not necessarily immediately jumping on board. So I think sometimes when people say, I don't have a support system, the closest people around you won't always be your cheerleader.
That's right.
And they don't have to be.
And you can respect them and love them. And like you said, they don't have to agree with you. And I also think managing and navigating that resistance is important, because any time that you're in a creative field or you're doing something that's unique and outside of the box, you're going to meet resistance.
I want to talk about a story full circle, because it's so timely, because your book just hit number one.
Thank you.
You have an incredible story that is actually perfect in this moment and on the theme about you fighting for the book cover you wanted.
Oh my goodness.
And here's a great example of even you having achieved so many different success and having a book deal and everything like that. Tell us about the story of the book cover.
Yeah. So we were kind of going back and forth creatively, really collaborative, productive discussions. Should the book cover just be font-based, meaning like just words on the cover? Because figureoutable is a very long word. And trying to navigate how to fit my name and that word so it's clear and understandable, we're like, should we just do text? Should it be concept-based? Like, so for example, you know, folding up paper or something that's more graphically designed, should that just be it? Or should I be on the cover? We eventually all landed on, and we tried different things in sketch form. Clarity comes from engagement, not thought. And we all intuitively felt that I needed to be on the cover. I was like, okay, great. So we did a photo shoot. And when all the photos came back, we were trying to figure out how to do the layout. And we came down to two covers. One cover had a particular pose, and they did the layout where you could very, very clearly read the words, everything is figureoutable. And the pose was just something that felt a little reserved to me. So this one cover was more, let's call it the basic cover for everyone listening, right? Like, you probably have seen something like it before. It was very expected. And then there was another cover, which turns out to be the cover that we've used, that I felt something when I saw it. The publisher did, the creative director, all of Team Forlia were all like, oh my goodness, that's it. It's very unusual because the type is overlaid with my face. It's not the easiest to read at first glance, but design is really important to me. Art is really important to me. And I'm like, I feel something when I see this versus this one. So the publisher said, okay, let's test them. You know, we have such sophistication now when it comes to technology. We can split test. We can put this in front of thousands of people and see which ones they prefer and let the data tell us which cover is going to be the winner. Okay, so we go through these tests. The data comes back. The basic cover was winning 5-1. 5-1. So it was hard for me to make an argument at that point. And by the way, Drew, this was at a point in the process where the launch of the book is ramping up. And for anyone who's launched anything, you know, you're launching a family, you know that when you're kind of coming into this phase of getting something out into the world, it is extremely busy. So I am, you know, booking podcasts, I'm being interviewed, there's all these things happening, the concert we're building, all this stuff. And so for a week or two, I was like, okay, the data just told us which one we should go with. Who am I to ignore the data? Great. I said, we're going to go with the more basic cover, even though a little part of my heart was like dying. Come to 2 weeks later, and it was the deadline. I knew it was coming up where we were going to have to basically send the book off to the printers and nothing could ever be changed again. Drew, it was a Friday afternoon in New York City, about 5 p.m. The body, my body, had a revolt. I literally got the strongest signal I've ever got in my life, where it was like, you cannot go ahead with the basic cover. Like, the voices again came through, and I was terrified. This entire publishing process has been really, really lovely. And I've heard nightmares from other friends who are authors who, you know, there's just not always an alignment in terms of vision or how things should roll out. And I was like, oh, I can't do this. I didn't want to do this, but I texted the big boss, my publisher, on like 5:30 on a Friday afternoon. I was like, I am so sorry, Adrian. I was like, I need to talk to you ASAP. Can you please call me? Had no idea where he was. He was like just in Germany at an international book conference. And again, I'm like sweating, thinking I don't want to be a drama queen here. He called me back and he's like, Marie, are you okay? I said, I am, but I'm not. I said, Adrian, I know that the basic cover won from a data perspective, 5-1, but I will tell you this, I cannot move ahead with this book unless we have the cover that we want. And the winning cover is the other cover. I said, I know it does not make sense from a logical place, but it's emotional. And we had this discussion. And he said, I trust you. I trust you. He's like, we will absolutely go with the cover. I'll go back. I'll tell everyone we're switching this. You will have the cover that you want. And it was the most gratifying moment. First of all, I have to just give kudos to my publisher for trusting me. And then he revealed that not only the creative director, but there was most people on the team who also believed that this was the winning cover, as did my agent, as did my entire internal team. There was literally this huge celebration. And so we got the cover that we wanted. But it was, again, you know, you would think like after 20 years of me doing this that I would like trust myself. But I still use the lessons of these book every single day. That's kind of, you know, part of this story right now. And I think it's so important to trust. And then we heard, cut to, once the cover came out, we had a lot of feedback from other publishers going, oh my goodness, it's the best cover ever.
When you're winning, everybody's on board.
Yes, 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 yes.
And I think that an important point about that story is that how even if the book hadn't do as well sales-wise, yes, as it has done, anything that you made the right choice for you.
Yes.
And there are times we had this Dr. Joan Rosenberg on the podcast, and she said, you know, confidence is not that going into a situation and knowing that it's going to work out. Confidence is knowing that you have the ability to go into any situation, and even if it doesn't work out, you're still going to be okay.
Yes. And you're satisfied with your choice because you followed your soul. You, yes, followed your intuition. I would have been so disappointed if we had that basic ass cover on right now. I honestly, this is what I told Adrian. I said, look, I give everything 120%. That is who I am. And I know if I let this go with the cover that I don't want, it will damage my ability to be behind the book because it's not a true expression of me. This layout, this pose, that's not the real me. The one that's on the cover right now, that is the real me. And if you give this to me the way I want it, I guarantee you I will work my ass off to get it out as big as it possibly can be. And I did.
So I want to pivot for a second and go back to some of the themes inside of your book and the things that derail us from figuring things out and,
yes,
putting our heart and soul into whatever it is that we want to give love and attention to. And you talk about the most common excuses that derail us in the track and how to reframe our thinking around them. So first of all, why did you dedicate an entire chapter on excuses?
Because I think excuses are one of the deadliest things that hold all of us back. And here's what's true. All of us make excuses from time to time. I do it, you do it, everyone listening does it. So this is not about making ourselves feel bad or shaming ourselves or beating ourselves up. It's not about that at all. But it is about getting real with ourselves. So A, we can stop feeling so powerless against our circumstances, and B, we can start creating real change. And if we don't want to create real change, we don't have to beat ourselves up about it. We could just be like, this is what I'm choosing right now. So we all make excuses from time to time, but here's the best way I've ever found to start to unwire them. And before I go into that, the three primary buckets of excuses that we usually make fall into these categories. I don't have enough time, I don't have the money, or I don't have the know-how. So the know-how piece, quite frankly, is a weak argument because given technology and where we are right now in society, if you have access to any internet, in less than 3 or 4 minutes, you can start finding an answer. You can start getting a clue to learn just about everything. And most times you can learn or start learning for free. So we're going to take that one off the table. So time and money tend to be the two that trip us up the most. And the best way I've found to start to unwire that is to look more deeply at our language, and specifically two little 4-letter words that can screw us up: can't versus won't. So if anyone listening has ever said, you know, I really want to start working out again, but I can't because I don't have the time. I'm too busy with work and the kids, right? Or my goodness, that design class looks amazing. I would really love to take it. I think it would open up a whole new career, but I can't because I can't afford it. Or if there's something that you want to pursue, but you're like, I really want to get started with this project, but I can't because I don't know how to get started. Those are things, again, I've said stuff like this to myself before. I don't know if you ever have.
Of course.
Yes. So again, anyone listening, this isn't about coming down on you. And the reason I'm saying this is because excuses tend to be the topic that people can get the most sensitive and prickly about. So that's why I just want to set the stage, because people can get really defensive. And I'm like, look.
We fight to hold on to our excuses.
Correct. So I'm just saying, again, we all make them. But here's what's cool. Anytime you catch yourself saying the word, I can't, if you exchange that word for won't, what we usually discover is something much more true. Now, what does won't mean? So when we use the word can't, 99% of the time, what we really mean is we won't. Won't means that we're not willing to, that we don't want to, that we don't want to do the work. We don't want to put in the sacrifice. We don't want to be uncomfortable, be inconvenienced, take the risk, so on. So let's go back to those examples, right? Rather than saying, I can't get up or I can't find the time to work out, I won't find the time to work out. Rather than saying, I can't afford that design class, I won't afford that design class. Rather than saying, I can't get started because I don't know how, I won't get started because I don't know how. The won't thing is really interesting, because here's what's true. I can tell you a few stories from my own life, Drew, but I'm curious if you have one for yours. Have you ever found yourself in a position where you wanted something so badly, but you didn't have the time, or you didn't have the money, or you didn't have the know-how, but you wanted it so much that you overcame those excuses and made it happen? Have you ever had that?
100%.
Right? I think all of us have. I've certainly had those times in my life, which proves that it's really not can't, it's won't. Because when you want something bad enough, you wake up early, you find the time, you create the time. We human beings are incredibly resourceful, but we lie to ourselves about our priorities, right? About what's really important. And so I think if you just try on that phrase and just say, I won't, or I don't want to right now, that's not my priority. Other things are more important. What happens is you feel a whole lot of freedom. And here's why the distinction between those two words is so important. Can't is a word that keeps us in a disempowered place. It's as though we don't have any control over our time or our energy or our life choices. And I don't know anyone who can figure things out or make their dreams come true if they feel powerless and helpless, right? Won't is a word that's very empowered. We feel like we're in control of our priorities. I'm choosing to do this, or I'm choosing not to do this. And when you feel like you're in that place of choice and you have autonomy, everything becomes possible for you.
You're happening to life, not life's happening to you.
Correct.
And I think what's important about the can't versus won't is that you often say that the can't, I sometimes hear people say like a hard can't.
Yes.
But oftentimes it's like disguised a little bit. It's like a soft, like, oh, this week got so busy and this all these things are going on. Haven't had the chance to write or work on that side business or whatever.
Correct.
Or life is so nuts right now or whatever it is. And it's a softer can't. It's a disguised can't that's out there, but it's still a can't.
Correct.
And it's usually disguising some sort of fear. And this is where another of your ideas comes in about how procrastination is so tied into fear.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one more thing on the can't versus won't before we go there. It's like, I have a dream to someday speak Italian fluently, but it's not my priority right now. And you know right. How I know that? Because if I had a break, like when I was putting the finishing touches on the book and working like 12 hours a day, and when I got done, I didn't then pick up my phone and start learning more Italian words. You know what I did? I watched Stranger Things on Netflix because that's what I wanted to do. So I'm not going to tell myself I can't learn Italian right now. I'm too busy. I don't have the time. That's not true. It's not the truth. It's that I won't, or I don't want to, or it's not my priority. So again, I just want to make
sure. Also, that's okay in a way is what you're
saying.
It's totally okay to look at your life and say, you can't just do everything at the same time.
That's right.
And things may shift and circumstances may shift, and I won't want to do that right now.
That's right. And sometimes parents say to me, but I have, you know, how many kids are, but I really can't. And I'm like, well, what if your priority is your children right now? And that's the priority, and they should be the priority. So let the pressure off of yourself and be appropriate to the season and stage of life. And you could just say, no, I'm not going to go after this particular dream because right now I am in my dream of raising my family, and that's okay.
You know, in the book, you talk about how this, when you really step into this idea of everything is figureoutable, it could be used for things that are mundane, like fixing a dishwasher or your mom fixing the roof to, or Tropicana radio. Yeah. to working on your business, relationships with your kids, every aspect in life. When you understand this philosophy, this framework, you can step into anything. But you also have examples in your book about when you step into it on even a global level or a countrywide level.
Yes.
And you have an incredible story about, she was a young woman at the time.
Yep.
Lima Bowie.
Yes.
And I would love for you to just share that story and how that plays into this theme of when we step into just figuring things out.
Yes. So Lima Bowie's story is in a chapter about refusing to be refused, which is a core tenet of the Figureoutable philosophy. And if you don't know Lima's story, she wrote an incredible book called Mighty Be Our Powers. And there's also a documentary that was made about her and her journey. I think it's Pray the Devil Back to Hell or Pray the Devil Back. So stunning. I highly recommend it to anyone listening. The short story is this. Lima was actually born in Liberia, in Monrovia. And as she was growing up, you know, she was about to graduate high school. She wanted to be a doctor when civil war broke out. And she was forced to flee, her and her family. And there was incredible violence. It was just so horrific and destructive. I mean, child soldiers and rape and murder everywhere. She eventually made her way back to Monrovia when the fighting had settled down. She wanted to re-pick up her life, but she had married someone who was abusing her. She already had children. Like, just her life had taken a turn that she didn't expect. Civil war broke out again. And so all Lima and so many people in her country, all they wanted was peace. And it just seemed like it was never going to happen. So Lima took it upon herself. She had studied the teachings of Gandhi and Jesus Christ.
Martin Luther King.
Yeah, Martin Luther King, and really started to do this deep dive into the work of how do we create peace through nonviolent methods. And she came up with this entire strategy. She gathered all of these women together and they started to sit in protest of the war. And they sat in this field for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, demanding peace, demanding peace, demanding peace. They got incredibly creative. No matter how many people didn't take them seriously, they refused to be refused. And they said, no, we will bring peace back to our country. This is what must happen. And it took them years and years and years. And again, I won't give away too much of it, but the punchline is this. Through refusing to be refused, Lima and the women that she partnered with got to the place where they actually brokered a peace deal and helped bring the war to an end. And it was so monumental that in 2011, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and actually helped to usher in Liberia's, I believe it was their first female president. And so just the fact that this idea was in her head, that she could figure out how to help stop a war through nonviolent means, and that she gathered people with, and by the way, she didn't have any financial resources. It wasn't like she was a politician. None of the people that she worked with, they didn't have any traditional political power. They did it merely through creativity and through their belief in the fact that peace was necessary, and they refused to be refused. So it's just one of the many stories that we tell that kind of illustrates how outside of even our own personal issues, the Figureoutable philosophy can help us create real change in the world.
It's so powerful. And there are so many great stories like that. I really appreciate them. It's
Thank
a nice
you.
Way to break out the book and also to humanize the lessons that are inside of there. And when I was reading the book, her story really set up the last section, which I think is such an important thing. You know, I have this friend, his name is Bassam, and he wrote this ebook, and the message of the ebook, it was years ago that he wrote this ebook, and actually I first found out about it from Seth Godin because he linked it up on his blog.
Oh, cool.
And then I realized we had some mutual friends. And in the book, he was basically saying, like, if you are in a privileged place where you can actually choose what you want to work on, if you can actually even have the remote chance of shooting for your dreams,
yes,
that you're not in war-torn Syria or in a place that doesn't have access to anything that's out there, you actually owe it to the world. It's not about you. It's about something much bigger than you. And ultimately, when we think about our success and our story and everything like that, if we're just focused on it inside of ourselves, and this is just about me, and this is just about my journey and my success, and I want to go for this job, but this is actually so much bigger than that. And in the last part of the book, you talk about how the world needs to hear this. You know, so many people out there, it's a long question, but so many people out there feel it's all been said and done.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's already talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
I have these thoughts and ideas. I want to make a difference in the world. I want to give back, even if it's, I want to give back to my children's school.
That's right.
Or I want to help start with this nonprofit or just be a better human being. But how am I going to make a difference? And you say that No matter how many times you think you're an idea or creation is shared in the world, sometimes it takes that one person expressing it in their unique voice at the right time in the right place for it to actually make a difference. And I think that's such an important message for the book.
It's everything. So to set some context for this, you know, one of the things I say at the end of Marie TV every week, it's at the end of every podcast, is the world needs that special gift that only you have. So I try and instill this in folks because I believe this to be true, that, you know, God, the universe, source, whatever higher power you may or may not believe in, I don't think any of us are here without a deep purpose. Like, there's no extra people, right? And every single person has a unique set of talents and gifts and perspectives and stories that they and they alone are here to contribute. And when you have an idea for something you want to create or a change that you want to make, even if it's in your own life, and you don't do everything in your power to make that dream come to life or to figure it out, you are stealing from those who need you most. There is some person that's out there that's either waiting for your message, your product or service, or that looks to you as an example, or that will look to you as an example of what's possible. I'll tell a really quick story, especially for those who are going, but wait, everything's already been done or said before. I remember when Josh and I first got together and we're a couple, I was still bartending and waiting tables. I was at the very beginning of my business, and he's an actor. So he would go away and shoot a TV show or a film. And he'd come back to our apartment, and in the trash can, there was, like, you know, empty boxes of Kraft macaroni and cheese and, like, Chef Boyardee. It was like, you know, old terrible eating habits from my past, right? And he was so sweet. He was like, you know, we should really eat more vegetables. And he would try and, like, get me to start taking supplements. And he's like, Marie, we should really start juicing. And of course, at the time, I was like, whatever, hippie man, I'm working like four, you know, part-time jobs. I have no extra cash. I don't have time to learn your granola loving ways. So fast forward like a few years, and I became and met my best friend on the planet, Chris Carr, who's like this wellness icon, and she's a cancer thriver. She's got all these New York Times bestselling books. And so one day I come home and I'm like, Josh, I met the most amazing woman. She's got all these recipe books, and, you know, she talked to me all about superfoods, and here's the supplements we should take, and, oh, we should get this juicer. And I was like, we should have started this years ago. And Josh had an obvious facepalm moment. He's like, what are you talking? I've been telling you the exact same thing for years. Why couldn't you hear it from me? And that's the point. So there are people out there, no matter how many times that you think something's been said before or something's been done before, it's not going to land for them until it comes from you.
So, funny story about that.
Yes.
I don't know if you actually remember this, but I had heard about you through, this was back in like 2009.
When we were having our conference at Donna Karen's Zen Center.
Yes.
Yes.
And so I think I just met briefly over there.
Yes.
And I don't know if it was a little bit before that or after that, but I was friends with Chris.
Yes.
And I saw both of you guys, your energy, how you showed up. I sent you guys an introduction email. And I said, Marie, you have to meet Chris. Chris, you have to meet Marie. And then you guys became friends after that.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. That's amazing.
Anyways, the small note of that is that when I was in college, that kind of plays into your story, and I was like, okay, this isn't right for me. I didn't know what I wanted to do in business. I'm not a natural born entrepreneur. I didn't have a ton of random jobs and other things like that, but I had to get good at business because I wanted to live the life that I wanted to live, which was working with my friends and family and doing that. And I said, I don't know where this is going to turn up, but just every week I'm going to make a dedication that I'm going to send out one introduction email. I'm going to connect two people that are out there. I have no idea where this is going to end up, what it's going to be, let alone I'd figure out that it would be the platform of many people I introduced would become friends, or ultimately we'd end up working together or some component. Okay. It's just an example of, like, just starting on things, but you're not, even if you don't know what it's going to turn out to be and connect with. But it's such an important message. And I think that they're just going back to your point, there is this ultimate thing where people are still wondering, do I have anything to say?
Yes.
And this last part of the book, I think, hits home to that, because ultimately there has to be this deep down trust that the things that you're feeling, the voices that you're going through, the ideas you have, the things that you want to bring into fruition, they're not a mistake, that they're for a reason.
They're there for a reason. And one of the things I've noticed for me is when I don't listen to what's happening in my heart, that's when kind of all of the destructive thoughts, I don't feel good about myself, I can start comparing myself to others. You know what I mean? You just kind of have this negativity spiral that goes down. But when you pay attention to those signals in your heart and those creative impulses, and you start to act on them, even when it's difficult, even when you're scared, even when you don't know how it's going to turn out, you actually do feel more joyful, you feel more healthy, you feel more energized. And I will tell you, you know, as we wrap up our conversation, when we're thinking about our brain, a really simple thing, if you take nothing else away from this interview, but just keep repeating the words, everything is figureoutable to yourself. Repetition is a key principle in neuroplasticity. That is how we retrain our brain to think in new ways. And so if you just did that for a few minutes in the morning, at lunch, and in the evening, anytime the shiitake hits the fan, you repeat that phrase, everything is figureoutable, you will train your brain to think more creatively and optimistically, especially in the face of setbacks.
It's so important. It's the way to break that default neural network and step into a new possibility.
That's right. And I we say this in the book, but it's important for people to hear. The most powerful words in the universe are the words you say to yourself. That's why it's so important. Just say this simple phrase as many times as possible, and you will see the changes in your life.
Marie, it's an excellent book. Everything is figureoutable. The campaign, how you've brought it out there, and really the message that it stands for.
Yes.
The message of possibility, the message of hope, which I think is more important than ever.
Yes.
In this day and age. Congratulations on being a number one New York Times bestseller.
Thank you.
For everybody that's listening, you could still get the book and get access to a cool course that your team created.
Yeah. So, well, this was funny. So when I turned in my manuscript for the first time, there was this bonus chapter, which what didn't seem bonus to me, I thought it should be included in the book. And my publisher and editor were like, you know what? We feel like the book ends here, which is on The World Needs Your Special Gift. And there was all this advanced material that I had created that was brand new. And they're like, no, it just feels like it's extra. And I said, I was disappointed at first. And then when I looked at it with fresh eyes, I was like, oh, this material is extra, but I could teach it much more effectively if I had the benefit of my voice and fun sheets and could do it in a multimedia format. So we created this course out of that material called the Figureoutable Formula. And I want people to have it because there's a ton of neuroscience and behavioral science. It really teaches people a simple acronym that they can use in 90 seconds or less that can help you instantly turn around any fear, any self-doubt, and get yourself moving again. But we're doing that in October, and it's completely for free for anyone who buys the book in any format. So Audible, Kindle, you know, whatever format, all you have to do is go to eifcourse.com. You'll see all the details. And again, there's no upsell, there's no anything. I just really want people to have this material. And because I've spent two decades teaching people, especially online, I think we're going to have an incredible time doing it.
Exactly. The book is just step one, and it's like being part of a community and around a group of people and continuing the lessons that are inside there. And you're so good at that. And you've created a lot of different systems that are out there to help people. I want to give a huge shout out to your parents.
Oh, you know, thank you.
I'm not a parent. I want to be one day, but just having friends who are parents and then recognizing just how special my own parents are and supporting me in my journey. Just a major shout out to your parents for raising a human being that they didn't try to change you.
Yeah.
Right? They God let you bless be who them. You are.
Totally. And I will, they're both super fun and super playful even now. Like I get these random videos from my parents doing like the strangest, quirkiest, funniest things. And I adore them. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. And thank you for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast. Everything is figureoutable. It's out. Go get it. Beautiful cover. Click on the show notes. You can find everything and you can sign up for the free course. Marie, thank you for being on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.